Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, great news about the humpback whale, whose numbers are growing after decades in decline. We meet the Irishman, who took part in a 230-kilometre ultra event in Kenya in support of wildlife rangers. And we ask, just what is it about the Kerry slug that makes it so special?
The spots of the giveaway, yeah. So if you find a large slug that's sort of gingery hazel brown in colour, covered in yellow and white spots, it's definitely a Kerry slug. If you find a jet black slug that's covered in white spots, it's also definitely a Kerry slug as well.
If you put it in a matchbox and look away and look back in it and it's gone out of it, it's definitely a Kerry slug.
Yeah.
So a busy show ahead of us today, and a busy studio. Richard Collins and Aine Nilana are with me today, as is Mark Ruddock, Red Kite Project Manager for the Golden Eagle Trust. And that's where we start our programme. Mark is also joined by his father, Dougie Ruddock, who I met recently. Hello, Dougie. How are you today?
Good morning, Derek.
You're going to tell us a fascinating story. At least if it isn't going to be fascinating, make it up. As I always say to people, if you can't make it interesting, make it up. Right. And Mark, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Derek.
Now, Mark, the Red Kites, tell us more. Take us back to the beginning for the benefit of people who are hearing this story for the first time. The Red Kite in Ireland.
Absolutely. The Red Kite in Ireland is, well, as we stand now, is a conservation success story, a species that was extinct in Ireland and brought back through a partnership between the Golden Eagle Trust, National Parks and Wildlife Service, and the Welsh Kite Trust. And we brought over 160 red kites from Wales, and those were reintroduced to County Wicklow and North County Dublin. And we now have a very successful red kite breeding population in Wicklow and over into Wexford now as well, and in North Dublin and Meath we have a population of over 80 pairs of kites now. And on an all-Ireland basis, the reintroduction that happened in Northern Ireland, we're well over 100 pairs of kites on the island of Ireland now.
That's fantastic. So they didn't suffer the fate of some of the other birds of prey that were brought in. Did they suffer from poisoning? Were they shot? Were there any kind of other awful tragedies they met?
Unfortunately, we have some ongoing issues with poisoning and occasionally shooting, but generally people in Wicklow and across the country have welcomed these birds. But unfortunately, we still do lose a couple. As a specialist scavenger, of course, they're very vulnerable to things that are laced with poison, or indirectly through things like rodenticides as well. If they're scavenging or eating dead or dying rats, they can become victims themselves.
So that's secondary poisoning. That's not deliberate. But have there been deliberate attempts to kill them?
We have certainly come across, there are chemicals, things like carbofuran and alpha-chlorolose. Carbofuran in particular has been banned in the EU since 2001. And that's just something that shouldn't be out there and shouldn't be getting.
So you think that's been left out there deliberately?
It has to be.
So you're talking about a prey item that's been laced with this stuff and then the bird comes down and takes it?
Typically the things that would be found very often, carbofuran, species that are killed by it, don't go very far from their last meal. This stuff is incredibly toxic and very often they're found dead right next to the bait that perhaps they've been eating. Whether those baits are left out for other species, which of course is now illegal, things like foxes. Once upon a time, people may have done that, but that of course now is illegal, leaving meat baits out with any poisons. But as I said, the specialist nature of a scavenger like the red kite and also like the buzzard, they're the first to find these things. They're the vultures of the Irish countryside, and they're very quick to get exposed.
Before we let Aine and Richard in, I suppose we should at this point, for again the benefit of the listeners and for myself, to remind me, what does a red kite look like? What is it?
Well, the name gives it away. There's a reddy colour at least. fascinating birds, and of course the most distinctive. They're reasonably large, about a 4 to 5 foot wingspan. Very, very graceful in the air. Fantastic flying species. And the most distinctive thing to look for, of course, is the forked tail. They have a very distinctive forked tail. Of talking to people over the last couple of days, even just how confiding kites can sometimes be, literally hovering and flying right over the tops of people, tend to be quite confiding compared to things like buzzards or sparrowhawks, which people get either further away or
if you look at an office building and you see a decoy on top of the office building, which is tethered by a wire or a rope, the way it moves around in the wind is often what I think of when I see a red kite.
Absolutely. And then of course over the summer we had a chance to see so many of them and work alongside yourself with those as well. And they are just so graceful, and this time of the year, coming into this season, is the best time, I think, in Ireland for kites. Coming into the winter, we've got these big aggregations coming in through the villages and towns, particularly in Wicklow and Avoca Village at this time of the year, all the way through to Christmas and early January. The roost site with over 100 birds circling and gliding and floating around the village is just a
spectacle. And the call they make is lovely, isn't it?
That whistling sound call, yeah. Is just absolutely
spectacular. There used to be a common species in our towns before they became extinct. I mean, the kite, it was called the kite because they actually collect clothes and bits of rags and socks and goodness knows what to put into their nests. They're not at all considered to be a bird of towns any longer. So in spite of us all thinking the world is getting worse, I mean, they were able to live in towns because of the filth in the towns, because of the amount of rubbish and sewage and everything else that was there then. So is this an improvement or a disimprovement?
Well, I think gradually as the population expands in Ireland, we're actually seeing them coming closer and closer in towards people and very close in and around farms. We've now got nests in people's back gardens. And we do see that the ancient name, the cloth kite, that we've got them actually now collecting rags and bits of toys and footballs and all sorts of unusual items adorning some of the nest sites with. And we do, there's some people in Wicklow that literally look out their kitchen window and they've got a kite nest in the back garden, which must be a pretty incredible scene to see.
Because they nest in trees, obviously, so if you have a good, decent tree, another reason for having a tree in your garden.
Absolutely, and that was one of the reasons why we selected Wicklow as the reintroduction site, the most heavily wooded county in Ireland. Trees are fundamentally important. We do find them in some of the larger native woodlands. They do use conifer plantations, the edges of them occasionally, but typically we've actually got them in small copses, hedgerow trees. You'd be amazed at how a small ash tree in a hedgerow that's just allowed to get away turns into a lovely specimen of a tree, and we've got a number of kite nests now nesting in those.
It is a pity about the rodenticides I mean at least the new regulations that have come in now that have banned permanent baiting except by trained professionals in a particular situation. Permanent baiting is otherwise banned. This is bound to have an impact on the availability of poisons left out all the year round, and must hopefully, I mean, this only came in this year, this permanent baiting ban, and it'll have an impact surely on the amount of poisons that are in the wild there to be picked up by birds of prey, would you think?
Absolutely. I think anything, you know, rodenticides are a necessary tool for work that people need to do. But I think the key message of the campaign for responsible rodenticide use, obviously, is think wildlife. There is something at the other end of the chain that potentially may become exposed to that. And kites and buzzards and barn owls and a number of species in Ireland still do face that challenge. So anything that makes an improvement or reduces the risk of accidental exposures is obviously going to be of benefit to this species.
Mark, a mad idea comes into my mind when I see that wonderful profile you describe with the big forked tail. Now, the nearest thing to it that I've ever seen is the frigate bird. Further south, the seabird that doesn't actually land on the sea. Now, they say that this thing prefers the air so much that it actually sleeps up there. Now, surely the kite must be tempted to sleep on the wing or spend an awful lot of time on the wing. How much of its life is spent up there? Is the ground something it has to visit reluctantly to breed and to feed?
Certainly whenever we watch them, they just look like they enjoy flying is the way I could perhaps best describe it. They look like they derive great pleasure from it. Perhaps that's me anthropomorphising that, but they just look like they're enjoying that flight, and it's so effortless. There's hardly a wing beat, and they spend an awful lot of time doing that. We've noticed very often, especially young kites, we often find them over small hillsides, not too steep ground, but they just use a little bit of a lift, and very often they come down and you can actually see them, they just barely touch the ground catching beetles and invertebrates, and they hardly land. And we have seen a number of instances where they're actually eating on the wing. I've certainly never seen them sleeping on the wing. And we do know that they go into to big roost sites, in particularly in Avoca. And that's where they do certainly sleep in trees. But very, very rarely would you see them on the ground. And if anything, when they do land on the ground, we'd often see them picking through for worms or insects as well. Occasionally they will land and walk around, and they just look incredibly clumsy. So there's just they lose all that grace the minute they land on the ground.
Now, there's an extraordinary contradiction here. This bird has done so well. I mean, thanks to yourself, of course, and to others like you. It has been an enormous success. It's back and it's thriving, which is odd that it should thrive in these circumstances when it perished so easily in its previous natural circumstance. Hard to know, hard to believe this bird didn't survive when it has that reproductive capacity in the past. Why was it rendered extinct so easily?
I think the big thing, and perhaps the thing that some of us underestimate, is perhaps the extent and the levels of killing that went on for many of these species. Many of the predators, there was a bounty on them. There was an incentive for people to get rid of them. We know Ireland went through extensive deforestation and the loss of that level of habitat. They were driven into pockets of suitable habitat, as many of these species were, things like eagles, even harriers indeed. We associate some of those birds with very high mountains, but those are the last areas of remnant habitat that they were able to hang on in. And I think it wouldn't have taken much with the scale of deforestation that we had across Ireland in losing that species pushing that species into small pockets. And I think that there's no incentives, fortunately, these days for killing these species.
They're quite the opposite.
If anything, it's the opposite. And they have been able. And I think the key thing, I'm very privileged to have been involved in this project. There's a huge team of people. But really the biggest thing, the biggest support and the biggest humbling side of it that I find is the support that we get from landowners, from farmers, from people that are just so pleased to have these birds as part of the landscape. We know they're eating magpies and crows and rats, and people are genuinely pleased to see them back in the environs and actually enjoy having them around, as well as being a joy to see. Absolutely.
Let me just flatter you for a moment. Fantastic job, because it is a wonderful experience. It's like going to Belfast and the Albert Bridge around this time of year also to watch the murmuration of starlings there. Now you can go to Avoca in County Wicklow or in other villages in Ireland and just see the red kites overhead. That's fantastic. Anyway, listen, you've got a very unusual backstory which got you interested in wildlife in the first place. Tell us a little bit about that.
I do indeed. And there's a gentleman sitting beside me who is entirely responsible for that. I've been fortunate to have a father that has had a fascination with wildlife throughout his life. And that is certainly where I've developed that from. I was privileged through the early adventures of my father and mother in going to Africa, that I grew up in South Africa, born in Rhodesia as it was then, and then to South Africa, and fascinating existence with a plethora of raptors and rhinos, elephants, lions, leopards, all through my childhood. And certainly I'm privileged to do a lot of stuff with my dad across Ireland, and we've been back to Africa a number of times as well, and he's certainly where I've derived my passion from and feel very privileged to have had that upbringing.
It's great to see you both in studio, because the first time I met you, your dad, should I say, Dougie, was when we were doing a shoot for a programme which you can watch on RT television on the 30th of December at 6:30 p.m. That's a Monday evening. So for your Christmas viewing over the Christmas period, 30th of December, it's called Back from the Brink, and it's a programme that tells stories of conservationists right across Europe who are doing what Mark and his team have done, bringing back wildlife, or at least stemming the extinction of species in various different parts of Europe. At any rate, that's where I met Dougie for the first time. Dougie, you must be very proud of Mark, are you? Because you sat there really patiently and quiet, and you listened to you were hanging on every word he said.
It's just a fantastic experience to share my twilight years of my working career, hopefully, sharing that with my son's passion, which we've talked about over the years, and I think derived from some of the adventures we had in Africa. So,
well, talk to me about Africa. When did you go there? Why did you go there?
Well,
where are you from originally?
Yes, well, I'm from Hollywood in County Down. Lived there until the Troubles kicked off, and In 1975, just after being married, my wife and I emigrated to South Africa, partially to get away from the troubles. And in those years, South Africa was deemed as the land of milk and honey. And like Australia, lots of people emigrated in those 60s and 70s. And mm-hmm. In a way, I combined my engineering career with what was a bit of a passion, wildlife and animals.
Oh, so. You and Richard, he did the same thing. He's an engineer too.
I didn't chase conflicts all over the world.
No, that was one thing. We'd only arrived there within 3 months and the Soweto riots kicked off. So it was a bit of out of the frying pan into the fire. But I didn't even learn from that, because we moved from Johannesburg up to Bulawayo in what was Rhodesia, Zimbabwe now. And again, was able to continue with my hobby of wildlife.
And what was your first big wildlife experience there?
We went to a game reserve called Matopus, where Cecil Rhodes, where the name Rhodesia comes from, was buried on what they call koppies there, which are small granite mounds. In that area, there was a game reserve, and at that time, it had a really healthy population of rhino, black and white. I remember having a picnic once on an outcrop of rock and climbed to the top of it, and just on the other side of the rock, there was a white rhino just below us. And so that was one of those spine-tingling moments that will always live with me. And I've had various others, but that was probably the first one, you know.
Well, we asked you in really today to talk about your latest great adventure. And to say that you're an amazing athlete and adventurer is a bit of an understatement. Now, in the past, I'm told you've participated in the Marathon du Sable. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
That's correct, yes.
Which is a 6-day, 251-kilometre ultramarathon through the Sahara Desert. You've climbed Kilimanjaro. And you've competed for Ireland in triathlons. Your latest challenge was the Four Rangers Ultra Marathon in Kenya. This is about more than running. It's about supporting the Rangers, who are the last line of defence between vicious armed poaching cartels and the elephants and rhinos you just mentioned there. They're battling to protect. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I think I probably could have condensed that resume in just with one word, addiction, which I think my family would certainly reiterate, you know, and I continually get reminded of it. But yes, the latest, possibly the last long distance event was for Rangers, which in a way is gone full circle into that first instance that you just discussed.
What's the plight of the Rangers there?
With my past history, a lot of it's to do with African rhino, which have been decimated over the years due to poaching. And unfortunately, the only saving grace for them are the conservancies and the groups of enthusiasts and the bodies who have come together now at this late stage and are trying to preserve the global species of all rhino.
But you say the run is called again For Rangers.
For Rangers, yes.
So why For Rangers? What's happening to the Rangers?
Well, they are the boots on the ground. They are the people who are in the front line on what is a war on rhino. These animals are being slaughtered in tremendous numbers. Since 2006, over 9,000 African rhino have been slaughtered
for their horn.
Yes.
Because it's rubbish, because the horn is actually use to anybody.
It's keratin, it's the same as your fingernail, so it's used in various forms for as a status symbol and also in medicine, in traditional medicines. So there's a demand for it, and unfortunately, with that demand, the price of it has gone up and it's now more valuable than gold per kilogram. So it's a target now for organised crime. And the only people who are helping on the ground are the Rangers.
And their lives have been threatened also.
Yeah, well, in the last year, there are over 150 Rangers have died in Africa alone, protecting wildlife from poachers and in some cases from being killed by the very animals that they're trying to protect. Because let's face it, there's an element of risk that if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, then you know, you're going to come out second best.
So how can a marathon like you took part in this ultra event help Rangers?
No, wait a moment. Let's ask him how far did you run?
Well, I was going to get into that. Hang on a second. How does it help them?
It was very good.
It was 230 kilometres over 5 days. So it was basically a marathon plus per day over 5 days through six wildlife conservancies. This was over 5 days and it was self-sufficient. So everything, your food, your bedding, your clothing, you had to carry on your back and run with that. They provided water for you along the route.
Dare I mention your age?
You may, yeah.
You mention it. Avoid me mentioning it.
I'm 67 at present, so it's...
Must have taken some toll. But back to the question about how does this help the Rangers?
Well, a lot of the funding which goes are on the major items, whether it be drones or night vision goggles or weaponry and Land Rovers. It doesn't emphasise as much on the actual people who are, in many cases, ex-poachers and local people who look after the animals and who guard tourists. And so it's for life insurance, medical insurance, clothing, because in a lot of cases, these guys are going out into the bush in trainers and clothing that is inadequate for the conditions that they meet. So unfortunately, where there's maybe a death, a ranger is killed, there's now life insurance set up for the families. There's education programs in the villages because these people don't have the infrastructure that we would have, and it's very basic.
Richard,
do you have hope for them?
We have to have hope, you know. There's a tremendous amount of work being carried out. And some species are doing better than others.
But can they not attack the market? I mean, if nobody buys, if nobody wants the horn, then there's no market. Let the market collapse. I mean, other medicines over the years have been synthetically produced. I mean, I know that the actual efficacy of the horn is rubbish. But, I mean, presumably the people who receive it get powder, they get something. I mean, they don't actually receive in the horn. So could there not be some, that they get whatever they think they're getting, but they're getting it synthesized. It's still carried. And it's still all the thing, but it's not removed from a rhino.
I think
no work can be done on that. I mean, who's the market? I mean, who's buying this stuff?
Asia is the main market, both for traditional medicine where they use rhino horn.
What's it meant to fix?
Well, it's everything from a hangover to an aphrodisiac.
The doctor of signatures, that's the relevant thing. What does a rhino horn remind you of? So when you turn to the doctor of signatures, you would think, well, this must be good for that.
It has a phallic nature.
But they eat bits of tiger for that as well. And it's not to do, there's no phallic symbol on the tiger. It's just because he's a big, strong animal, very royal. But they'd be better off with Viagra. I mean, can they not plug that instead?
Yeah, well, again,
that would actually work.
You're dealing with a sort of, in some cases, an uneducated population.
Well, they've a few, Bob, haven't they?
Well, in the main. But I think governments are working more in conjunction, and there's certainly a higher profile now, and there's more pressure being put on governments to come up with solutions.
Well, would you go back to live there?
Africa will always be in my blood. I mean, it's a cliche, but it does get under your skin, and there's a side to Africa which I've always loved and I always will love and will go back and forward. Whether or not I would live there, I'm not sure.
Okay, well, listen, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming in. Very much appreciated. And you too, Mark. And again, to remind people, if you want to see the Red Kite in this programme, Back from the Brink, you can tune into RT1 television on Monday, 30th of December at 6:30 p.m. It's not every day that we hear the bearers of glad tidings here on Mooney Goes Wild with regard to the natural world, but today, for a change, we bring you good news about the humpback whale. Due to the decimating effect of the whaling industry throughout the 20th century and other factors, by the 1950s, the population of Western South Atlantic humpbacks was down to only around 450 individuals. But according to a new study published in the Royal Society Open Science Journal, those numbers have rebounded and grown to almost 25,000. Richard Collins spoke to Alex Zerbini, the study's lead author.
The goal of our research was to estimate the recovery of the Western South Atlantic humpback whale. And to do that, we integrated information on the current population size, how fast this population it was growing, how many whales were killed by whaling, and how many whales were killed but not landed. So we tried to estimate the proportion of animals that were struck by whalers, but they were never brought into shore for processing. And because they are not brought into processing, they were not counted as deaths in the whaling statistics. And what we found out is that the Western South Atlantic humpback whale population has recovered to almost 95% of the numbers that they once had before they were killed by whaling. So we estimated the population today to be at about 25,000 whales. And the pre-exploitation abundance was estimated to be at about 27,000 whales. So it's pretty close to being fully recovered.
Alex, you have done, I think, pretty unique research on the pre-whaling population of this mm-hmm. animal. Now, if we go back in time a couple of centuries, I have the impression, whether it's kind of guilt or something, that all the worst whalers came from the Northern Hemisphere and that people in the Southern Hemisphere didn't do any whaling sort of thing. So the exploitation of whales would have really began with the harpoon and the steam-driven ship. We could go to the South Seas even in winter in reasonable comfort and exploit whales. Is this model correct? Go back a few centuries and tell us what went on.
So a few centuries ago, whaling was done using what we call the pre-modern whaling methods, where we used rudimentary killing methods. So the harpoons were, you know, handheld. You would throw them at whales. You had to throw many harpoons to kill a whale. You would chase whales from sailboats or from rowed-powered boats. And it wasn't a very effective way of hunting, but that was the only technology available at the time. Well, at the end of the 1800s and the end of the 19th century, the Norwegians invented what we call the explosive harpoon or grenade harpoon, which is a much more effective way of killing the whales. And that added to like steaming boats and more powerful boats and faster, allowed us to explore more other species of whales and to hunt them in hospitable environments such as the Southern Oceans.
Well, now your population was exploited and went right down in the 1950s. When did protection become law?
So protection for humpbacks was proposed by the International Whaling Commission in the mid-60s, but the Soviets illegally killed humpback whales until the early 1970s. And then, it really became law, or it became more effective in the mid-1980s when a global whaling moratorium was implemented by the International Whaling Commission.
Well, now, it seems to me remarkable that it could get, from the 1980s to today, that it could get back up to 25,000. Given that a whale doesn't breed until it's five, and then it's going to take another 5 years for the baby to reach a breeding age in its turn. So in 10 years, a pair has only produced one youngster. Now, you have a minimal population with that terribly low reproductive rate. The sums don't seem to add up. How do you get up to the astronomical 25,000 in a decade or two?
Actually, for this population, the Western South Atlantic, they started to recover before the mid-1980s. The last humpback whale taken was in 1972 from this population. So that's when they started to grow back without any kind of hunting going on. And they do breed faster than most other whale species. So you're right that they become sexually mature at about age five, but females will have babies typically every 2 years, every 2.5 years. But in some cases, there are females that can have babies every year. So it is a relatively higher reproductive rate than other whale species. For example, like right whales. Right whales don't breed as fast. And because of that reproductive power, humpback whales can reach growth rates of about 10% per year, which will lead to a faster recovery.
So compound interest of 10% a year on the original population in the 1970s will give you 25,000 now, will it?
Correct. If you think about 500 to 700 whales in the 1970s to today, a growth rate of about 10% per year will give you about 25,000 today. Animals have to find themselves to breed, and that could take time, or in some cases, it might not happen at all.
So in other words, the singing and calling that the male does at the breeding areas is crucial to his getting a mate or securing mates. And if things get very thin on the ground, there's nobody listening and nobody can hear him. Is this the model?
Correct.
Is it true necessarily that that singing is about getting mates? I believe that no one has ever recorded a female approaching a male as a result of singing. And is it true that humpback whales are not territorial, so they're not staking out territories, and they may not even be securing females by singing? So what else is the singing about?
Well, the singing could be a form of communication. I mean, it is a form of communication. And as such, it may have multiple roles. One of them is attracting females. Only the males sing. The females don't sing. So the males could be actually singing to let other males know that they are there and, you know, maybe they don't want any kind of competition. But it could have other roles in terms of communication.
Why are they tribal? After all, if you want a partner, it doesn't matter to you that she comes from the tribe next door. In fact, it's an advantage in some ways because reproductively she'll be more interesting and more introduced your genes into your population. So why, it seems, they exclude the wrong dialect whales from their area? Is that true? And why would they do that?
I think that they don't necessarily exclude their own dialect. It's just that different populations will have different dialects in the breeding grounds. But because there is this separation of the breeding populations, typically the females from one region will mate with the males on that region, and the females from another region will mate with the males from another region. I mentioned before that there is this cases where one whale from one breeding population might go to another population. This doesn't happen very often. When it does, I don't think we really know what the fate of that animal is in terms of reproduction. In other words, we don't know if it's a male moving from one population to the other, then whether it's going to become reproductively active in that population. One possibility is that if a male comes to an area and sings a different song, he might be more attractive to females than all the other males that are singing more or less the same song.
Now, these are, among the great whales, highly cooperative animals. Now, the two that whales seem to hunt together and form coalitions and so forth for hunting purposes. But the humpback is, I think, probably unique. It's its own genus and everything else. It's on its own. And it has this social dimension. Is that a factor, or do you think that's a factor in its great performance, in the fact that it has outstripped the other baleen whales in recovery?
Yeah, it is very possible that because these animals have a more socially developed society, is not the right word for this, but it is possible that plays a role into their greater breeding success. And they're still hypothetical in some sense, but it is possible that large aggregations of humpback whales that are singing will attract animals from other regions to go and breed in that area.
It seems to me that the humpback is one of those iconic animals that is a blessing to conservationists because It is by far the most popular whale. It's the one that behaves so spectacularly with its great breaching and singing and flaunting its tail, which has got unique markings, enable it individuals to be tracked. It doesn't need to be ringed or tagged, as you would say. We owe it a great deal, it seems to me, in this world, because the public knows it. And if ever television wants to show a whale, it will surely be the humpback. It is a great animal, and I think we owe it a lot. What do you feel?
Oh, I feel that you're absolutely right. I think it is an iconic species. And because it presents this, we call aerial behavior, it, you know, it breaches, it comes out of the water, and it slaps tails, it slaps flippers. It's interesting to see. It's beautiful to see. The other thing is that humpbacks tend to congregate close to shore. Other species don't do that as much. So it's much easier for humans to have contact with these animals because they're so close to a beach or, you know, or within reach of a boat. So you're absolutely right.
Does it like us? All these whale-watching expeditions that go up very close to whales such as humpbacks, does it upset it to have boats come and look at it? Or is this rather like some pot-nosed dolphins that seem to cleave human contact and like the attention?
I don't know if we know that these whales like the attention. Some whales will approach boats, especially the younger ones. They're more curious. But I don't necessarily think that they like our presence or like the contact with us. It's more like they are interested in what's around them and they can get close to people, close to boats. But it also depends a lot on what they're doing. So if they are, for example, focused on feeding, they will not necessarily pay attention to us, but they are also not necessarily going to be bothered if we approach them. If they're resting at the surface, then their behavior is going to be different. And then the way that they interact with a boat might be different.
Have you any prescription before we finish up as to how we should behave or not behave in the interests of these whales?
I think the more we can do to minimize any kind of impact to whale populations, the faster we're going to see them recover and thrive. I think our paper, for example, showed that the moratorium whaling, the protection of humpback whales, led to the recovery of the West and South Atlantic humpbacks. There are many other populations that are showing similar trends, that they are recovering. And so this is the important aspect. We can take actions to minimize risks to whales and ensure that they recover or that the current populations are not going to go extinct.
Well, congratulations on your excellent research so far, and we wish you well for more research in the future. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you very much.
Now, the Kerry slug was catapulted into the limelight in recent months when an oral hearing into the proposed South Kerry Greenway heard that it would suffer from unmitigated noise disturbance in the construction of the 32-kilometre cycle path. The rare spotted slug, Geomalacus maculosus, is protected under the EU Habitats Directive. It's been found in numbers at two locations, one rock and one heath. But what's so special about this slug? We're joined in studio now by Dr. Aidan O'Hanlon, Curator of Entomology at the Natural History Division at the National Museum of Ireland. Aidan, what is so special about the Kerry slug?
Well, one of the reasons why it's protected in Ireland and internationally is because it only occurs in the southwest of Ireland and the northwest of Iberia, Spain and Portugal. It's the Kerry slug because it was found first in Kerry and later discovered in Spain and Portugal, so they wouldn't call it the Kerry slug. Colloquially, they'd probably just call it Geomalacus or the spotted slug. It's special because it's extremely rare globally. It only occurs, as I said, in a small pocket of the southwest of Ireland and northwest of Iberia. And at the time that it was included on the Habitats Directive, there were indications that populations in Iberia and northern Spain and Portugal were in decline. We now know that Irish populations of the Kerry slug seem to be in favourable status, at least according to the last MPWS Article 17 report. But it's still true to say that Ireland is a stronghold for this species. Legally, it's our obligation to protect the species anyway.
It's not our only slug, is it?
No, we've got about 30 or so different slug species. It's our only protected slug. I think it might be the only protected slug species in the world, as far as I know.
Can you describe it?
Yeah, so it's a large enough slug. There are two different colour forms. You find brown individuals live in sort of forested habitats, woodlands, and out in the open peatland areas like Blanket Bog, the slugs tend to be jet black with white spots.
And are they as big as your finger? I mean, you say big enough. I mean, we know the garden slugs. Some of them are huge.
Some of them are huge.
So how big is this one?
The garden slug is probably a good rule of thumb because they're
as big as your thumb.
They're a bit bigger even, but they're from the same taxonomic family. They're the same sort of body shape as well. The Kerry slugs are very distinctive because of their kind of colour and their spotted patternings that they have.
Because the one way of knowing a Kerry slug, apparently, I'm told, is you gather one as a specimen because you want to make sure that it's it. You put it in the matchbox. And when you open the matchbox again, there it is gone. Because it's absolutely able to squeeze itself into two dimensions. So it can slither out of the tiny little crack where the matchbox drawer closes. And no other slug is able to do that. Is that actually true?
They're definitely good at escaping. Myself and colleagues, we used to do behavioural experiments on them in our lab over in the Applied Ecology Unit in NUI Galway. And as part of that was we had this lovely sophisticated camera set up to track their behaviour. And we were interested in all sorts of things, but this would just sort of track their movement and we could manipulate experiments then. And they always escaped. And of course, that was in Galway and we were always worried that...
They're going to catch them on the camera escaping.
You would, yeah, but it's already too late because you'd leave them in a room with the camera on and go back later on and find, oh no, it's not in the arena.
There they are gone.
We'd always find them again, but we were always worried that because those experiments were in Galway, that if it shows up in Galway then we'd accidentally introduce a protected species onto the campus. But luckily we haven't found it there. We always recover
them. So they're indicators of ancient woodland then, aren't they? Isn't that one of certainly the woodland ones are in ancient woodland. That was their original thing. But they're here and they're in Spain and Portugal. Did they come to here from Spain and Portugal? Did they go to Spain and Portugal from here? Do we have any concept of where they came? Have we any DNA work done on them to tell us where they might have come from and how they might have come?
Yeah, this was probably the first mystery of Kerry slugs was this so-called Lusitanian distribution pattern that it only lives in the southwest of Ireland, northwest of Spain, and it's absent from the rest of Western Europe and Britain. So it puzzled people for a long time how it could have gotten here, because if it came naturally, you'd expect to find it sort of along the route from Spain into Britain and Ireland. But a friend of mine, Dr. Inge Reich, did some genetic work on Irish and Spanish populations a few years ago and found out that the genetic structure of Irish populations, that they're quite impoverished compared to their Iberian cousins, which have highly structured population-level DNA between geographic populations of the Kerry slug. So based on that, it appears...
Ours are all the same, essentially.
Ours are all the same, and not that they're all the same, but that they're it's the founder effect. Is basically, it's a good example of the founder effect. It shows that the Kerry slugs were probably introduced here as an ancient introduction at least hundreds of years ago, but maybe thousands of years ago.
So they would have come perhaps then with the Mesolithic peoples who brought us the pygmy shrew, which apparently has been traced back to Andorra. And there seems to be some evidence that these Mesolithic peoples came in small boats directly from the north of Spain to Ireland, hence not hopping off in France or in Britain, so that some other species are here and Spain as well. And it's these Mesolithic people, the hunter-gatherers, that would have done this way back maybe up to 8,000 years ago.
It's possible, yeah. One of the theories that Inge had, and it was based on some plants that showed up as well with a similar distribution pattern, was that whenever it may have been hundreds or possibly thousands of years ago, ancient people were wrapping up amphorae of wine in heathers from the mountains in Spain and transporting this as cargo over to Ireland. And that the mountains in Spain are sort of where this slug lives over there, in and amongst the heathers and the wetlands. And it only takes one because they're hermaphrodites.
Or even eggs,
exactly, yeah. And so then hundreds of years later now we have large populations.
Well, I mean, all our slugs and snails are hermaphrodite, but don't they need another hermaphrodite snail to do the business with? But these can bend over and do it to themselves, can they really?
They can, yeah. So all, as you said, all slugs and snails, terrestrial slugs and snails, are simultaneously hermaphroditic. Apparently, most slugs and snails will choose to outcross, will find a mating partner. But there's enough experimental work done, not with Kerry slugs, but with other slug species, that shows that they need a social cue. So if they're in an environment where they can't find another slug or snail, seemingly that's when they'll choose to self-fertilise and essentially produce clones of themselves.
I'd like to ask you about the animal itself. I mean, this is a specialist kind of animal. I remember seeing these slugs, and there was the big black Arianator slug in the same area. Yeah. They were quite common, the black version on the open there with the white dots was very common, and so was the Arianator. Now, what exactly specialised? All they're doing is scraping up algae and lichens. I mean, it's a very primitive kind of thing. What on earth is the specialisation of this beast? What makes it different? How does it make a specialist living in a place like Kerry where the other slugs don't?
Well, just on what you brought up about the colour of them, that you saw that the black slugs with the white spots, I assume it was out in a peatland or maybe in a clear field area.
It was on the McGillicuddy's reefs the last time. I have a great memory of them on the McGillicuddy's, and they were quite common. You know, you could see them in lots of places, and they're supposed to be nocturnal, and here they're out in the daylight. But go on anyway, I'm leading you
astray. It's probably raining.
yeah. Well, it turns out that apart from the Lusitanian distribution mystery, one of the other oldest mysteries associated with this species is why it appears in these two different colour forms. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we found out recently enough, and it's a fascinating story. So juvenile slugs hatch as these small, brown, creamy, white, yellow-spotted individuals in both open habitats like peatlands and in sort of oak-ash woodlands as well. In the oak-ash woodlands, as they become adults, after 2 years they become reproductively mature and they retain this brown coloration. And in the forest you find them only really living on tree trunks. So they move up and down the tree trunks in and amongst the moss, grazing on lichens that grow on the tree bark. And they are perfectly camouflaged. So when it was first discovered by a Dubliner called William Andrews back in 1842, he sensed that it might have been a species of some novelty, basically because it looked so much like the clumps of moss that he found it in. And then he sent it off to a Cork man called George Allman, who would later describe it as a new species and a new genus. But so there's always been that mystery as to why it's so perfectly camouflaged, and then indeed why are there two separate colours? Is it a genetic thing? Are there different
populations? You didn't try to, when you were photographing them escaping in between the times, you didn't take a woodland one and feed it on stuff from the bog and see would it change colour. You didn't try that, did you?
The story is even weirder than that. We tried to do a bit of that. We thought for a while it might have been diet related, because it makes sense that they might be eating different species of lichen on a boulder outcrop in a bog than what might grow amongst the moss on a tree. We found populations of them living in conifer forests as well, where they seem to thrive, which is even more unusual.
What colour were they there?
They're brown, but in a clear fell sites right beside it, you'd find the black individuals. And they're really noticeable because they're not camouflaged. They're not on a big dirty black boulder anymore. They're right out on a perfectly clean tree stump and they stick out like a sore thumb. So we thought that was unusual because 2 metres away you have a mature stand of forestry where you've got all the brown coloured slugs with the whites, with the yellow spots. They look exactly like moss. And then 2 metres away from that, you've got a clear fell site where they're all jet black. So that was a real head scratcher. And we assumed it was camouflage anyway. So myself and my supervisor did a study using digital photography with a standardised colour card in the wild. So we wanted to find out, first of all, is this camouflage? And so we sort of measured objectively the colour scores of the slug against the substrate and just measured them up that does the brown slug match the black substrate and vice versa. And so they're matched against the habitats that they live in. So in other words, the brown slug looks like a tree, the black slug with the white spots looks like a lichen-dotted boulder, but the camouflage doesn't work the other way around, so they're mismatched if they're in the wrong habitat. So that was interesting enough, and it turns out that what happens is, as the juveniles develop into adults, they require insulation to change colour. So they'll change colour within their lifetime if a slug happens to develop in an open habitat like a blanket bog or indeed a clear fell. UV radiation causes their skin to produce more melanin, and this gives them the correct camouflage.
So they're suntanned?
It's like an extreme suntan, yeah. And it takes about 6 months or so. In the lab, anyway, it took about 6 months. In Irish wilderness, it probably takes a bit longer because it's not that sunny all the time, but certainly UV is still getting through. So they seem to be able to change.
So the woodland ones are the pale-skinned ones who don't venture out into the sunshine.
Exactly.
And the ones out in the open bog, it's to do with the amount of UV light and similarly a clear fell. So it's not to do with the background, it's to do with the incoming radiation.
Exactly, yeah. And they hedge their bets by being able to become one colour or another in each habitat type.
And has it got ears?
No.
Well then, how can it suffer from unmitigated noise disturbance in the construction of the 32-kilometre cycle path? I mean, what's going on there, really?
I'm not sure. I can't really comment on the Greenway situation because I haven't read the plans. I haven't read any of the environmental impact statements.
But surely noise is the wrong word. I mean, there's going to be disturbance if they're putting in a cycle path. They're changing. They must obviously have to make a track through things. But, I mean, noise. I mean, surely.
That's vibration. Noise is only vibration at the end of the day. And presumably they will detect vibration in the ground. So they are sensitive to vibration.
Yeah, but I mean,
seems very odd indeed to suggest that making a track is going to endanger a species which is strong and probably thriving.
Well, we don't know whether this was actually permission is given or not. This was just something that was said at the oral hearing. But I mean, if the people who want to save the Sairy Clug they should actually say vibrations rather than noise, because people like me are going to say have the ears and things like this.
Now, the climate change is rushing ahead. Now, surely this fella is going to thrive. He's going to disappear in Spain and Portugal because they're going to become increasingly desert-like. So it won't suit them at all.
Are you sure of that?
Well, nobody's sure of anything. The future is always different from what we expected. In Ireland, it's getting wetter and it's moist, and it should be perfect for our Kerry slug, and he should be thriving. Is he thriving? And
are we the Limerick
slug? Is he one of those rare beneficiaries of climate change? Is he one that the people who were in favour of letting the climate go to hell, can they say, oh, the Kerry slug is with us?
Well, it turns out that there was some modelling work, computer modelling work done a few years ago, and they modelled the future distribution of Kerry slugs, or the theoretical future distribution of Kerry slugs, mapping its climate space and what's known about where it lives in Ireland now. And it looks like it will wean out. It'll be one of the very, very few weaners in the future. To go back to Richard's question about why this slug is unique, or is it unique in any way, is, again, for some unknown reason, when you pick it up, if you remove it from its substrate, it curls up into a ball. And the mucus doesn't go viscous then. It actually becomes really slippery and watery. I don't know why. I've always thought that was some sort of anti-bird mechanism.
Yeah, slip out of the bill.
Exactly, yeah.
Bird can't hold it.
Curls up into a ball and becomes very, very slippery. I'd imagine a bird would have a very hard time.
Snakes do something similar.
Well, slugs do ordinary garden slugs go like a fruit pastille or something.
They hump up a little
bit. But they're not a ball. Yeah. They're only like a humpy thing. These are complete balls. You could roll them along like a marble, could you?
You could, actually, yeah.
I'm surprised you haven't managed a captive breeding thing with this. I mean, it seems ideal. You should be able to set up something in the botanic gardens or somewhere with lots of moisture and have loads and loads of these fellows for us to see and bring the kids to see.
I thought the same thing too. I thought it'd be very easy, and it broke my heart, Richard. I did try and set up a captive breeding program. Again, we were collecting
slugs. But they all escaped.
They didn't all escape. No, some of them escaped and were subsequently recaptured, of course. But we were working with slugs. It's a protected species, of course. So
need a license.
We need a license, and our licenses were given from the National Parks and Wildlife. So you can only have so many slugs in captivity, and then you release them again afterwards after you're finished studying them. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I wanted to do was set up a captive breeding program, mainly to understand how they reproduce and when, what time of the year, how old they are and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. What numbers of eggs do they give off and so on. And also to have a conveyor belt of slugs to do more behavioural experiments with and figure things out. And it came up, I read a paper that was somebody from the UK was looking at pond snails, and they had a great captive breeding system. It was so easy. They gave the snails in captivity, they kept them in small lunch boxes and gave them everything they needed. So they had a full balanced diet, they had nice little shelters, and the only thing they were missing was any sort of a social element. So they'd separate them out individually into their own little containers for a period of about 2 months. And then when they put them back in together, the only new stimulus they had was other individuals of the same species, so they got into a breeding frenzy. And I thought, that's grand, I'll try that with the Kerry slugs. And I spent about 2 months just separating them out, keeping them all in individual containers.
Mind two months later, the crossroads, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. 2 months later, put them back in, again, just a pair of two slugs, watched them for another couple of months and nothing happened. And I go, all right, I'll give up. Eventually gave up, and then I sort of put them back into, I was keeping them in containers with more than about five slugs, I think it was. And as soon as I got them back into their big mixed containers, I went to check them one day and there were eggs everywhere. So I don't know if the experiment worked.
So they want to be at a dance. They don't want just an intimate relationship at a deux. So it's not couples.
It could also just be that they... Sorry?
It must have been about 2 years old before they breed or something like that.
It's they don't breed until... They don't become reproductively mature until they're at least 2 years old. And even
so
that...
You have to live a long time to do these experiments.
Yeah.
So they prefer the disco scene.
Maybe they do, yeah. But they live for 8 years at least. There's records of them in captivity living for up to 8 years. They don't become reproductively mature until they're about 2 years old. But even at that, it's very difficult to tell if you've got a fully mature slug, because even a slug that's about 6 months old could be a massive big thing.
How do you know all those eggs came from mating, or whether they all just mated with themselves then and discussed?
We don't know that either. Yeah, that's why I was heartbroken by that that waste of a few months that sort of went nowhere. But that's how research goes.
Well, you've brought it to life. Did the eggs ever hatch? I mean, did you ever have little babies?
Oh, they did. Yeah, they did.
You had to put all those back as well, had you?
Yeah. Reintroduced all of them.
Well, Kerry will never be the same again.
No. I'll never be the same again. That was fascinating, I have to say. It was really interesting. I know a lot more. I feel for the Kerry slug in a way that I never did before, I have to say. So, Aidan, thank you very much indeed for coming in. Thanks to Richard and Naina, to our sound operator, Sheila Neveal. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is John Riley. And producer is Anna Leddy. Until next time, goodbye. Are we here for blown up?
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney.